now I'd like to introduce our main speaker for the evening. Please give a warm welcome to Anne Marie from Hamul.
Hi, everybody. I'm Anne Marie. I'm alcoholic.
Anne Marie.
And my sobriety date is December 3rd, 1986. I know what you're thinking. Wow, she doesn't look like she's that old. She must have got sober when she was 10. I'd like to thank Randy for asking me to be here tonight. And I want to thank all the friends that are here that I see in the audience. I'm overwhelmed. Your love and support. Thank you. I'm the oldest of 9 children, born here in San Diego at Mercy Hospital. Two of my brothers are buried with my dad up at Fort Rosecrans, so there's 7 of us still living in the county with my mother. My memories of my childhood are very loving, very happy. I grew up wanting to be a nun. And from a very young age, I knew that that's what I wanted to be. And I had many nuns and priests in my family that sort of conditioned me over the years to prepare me for my journey. And my folks were sort of fine arts majors, drama fine arts majors. My father was a gypsy, kind of traveled, did a lot of different things, and ended up in the restaurant business, Mexican restaurant. I know, I don't look Mexican. Of course, that was our first experience to beer and wine, and that's where I identified that my family drank. My parents drank. And I didn't understand that it was alcoholic drinking until I was older. But it did cause problems and friction in my household. I do remember that. But my whole being was set to go to the convent. And so whatever happened in my household, I sort of was able to always forgive. And I didn't experience any drugs or alcohol all growing up. I graduated from high school early, and at age 17, I went to the BVM convent in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to become a nun. 9 months later, they asked me to take some time out. And reconsider my vocation. I was so humiliated, I couldn't come back home. And so I went to Chicago, where my folks were from, and I had family. And I lived with an aunt and uncle and 8 cousins. And I had my first drink there. And it was orange juice and vodka. And I remember it today, at this moment, standing here, as if I was there having that first sip. It was the most wonderful feeling, from my mouth all the way down to the tips of my toes. For the first time in my life, I felt like I was a fairy princess. I grew up kind of homely, glasses, long hair. My mother always kept it braided. I have to tell you this story. I was in high school, my freshman year in high school, and I had this beautiful dress on. It was the Christmas party, and my dad had this dress made for me for my 8th grade graduation. And I wore it to the Christmas party. And they had a piñata in the gymnasium. And it was my turn in front of the whole school to go and hit the piñata. And so they blindfolded me. And I go to hit the piñata, and this kid, Lester Kerner, all the way in the back of the bleachers, said, "Hey, you four-eyed red-headed woodpecker, you got your bra on backwards." And that image stayed with me for a very long time, And when I had that first drink, I didn't see that person. I felt like a princess. And when I had my first drink, my first experience with it, I blacked out, I threw up, and I had a hangover. And it didn't stop me. And I went to x-ray school. My uncle was a doctor. He was a radiologist. And he helped me get into x-ray school. And so that's what I did while I was in Chicago. And I learned to drink. My girlfriends, my roommates from school were all drinkers, partiers from the neighborhood, local bars, taverns, dancing, all of that. I did it for the first time, and I loved it. I loved being a party girl. I loved being able to dance. I loved being able to talk to a man. I loved being able to go to bed with a man for the first time. And I have to tell you this story, too. The first time a man took me to bed, I thought he loved me. I loved him. Anyway, it happened. And after it happened, and I was crying, I saw my dead grandmother on one end of the bedpost and the Blessed Virgin Mary on the other end of the bedpost. And I knew at that moment that I was a sinner and I was going to hell. And it didn't matter what else I did from there. And that's pretty much how I spent my drinking career. Not caring at all what I did, where I did it, who I did it with, when I did it, or why I did it. I came home after graduating from college and took a job at UCSD Medical Center, where I spent 12 years of my career, where I lost my career due to alcohol. And I was a bar drinker. I liked going to bars. I liked partying in the bars. I liked the lively noise, the music, the dancing. I was a disco dancer. And I had a disco partner, and we had lots of trophies. It was the disco days. But one night I was coming home by myself, and I got my first DWI. And it was right as I was pulling into my driveway, so I was really upset that I was getting picked up pulling into my driveway. Well, when you're dancing disco, you wear flared skirts and stiletto heels. Well, in the police report, it said they took my heels off because I was using them as a weapon. My first night in jail, I was so humiliated, I said, I'll never do this again. I'll never come back to jail again. I did not belong in jail. I had four more DWIs and a felony hit and run before I got sober. I spent a lot of time in Mission Valley, Crystal Tees, all those bars there. And there was another place, I can't remember. It sat in Point Loma. That was a really, really fun place to go. But those were the fun days. There was at some point, and I can't recall when, at some point I crossed over a line, and alcohol was no longer fun for me. And I needed more. I needed more to get that feeling. And I got into drugs. And in order to pay for the drugs, I needed to have a nighttime job. And I took a nighttime job at the Blarney Stone Pub in Claremont, where I could drink all night, buy my drugs, use my drugs to get up and go to work the next day. And it was a cycle that just got worse and worse and worse. And I started being a no-show at work, sick calls, no-show, not being able to wake up for coming to for a day or two, and eventually lost my job. I spent the next 2 years on and off the streets. After I lost my house, lost my car, and I moved into the North Park area, into an apartment in the North Park area with literally nothing. I had lost just about everything. And there were several bars along Adams Avenue that I frequented, including one called the Kensington Club, up next to the Ken Theater. And I used to go in there because I had a pool table and I liked to shoot pool. And there, the owner of the bar, Leroy, he was a great character. And when he drank and I drank and we started having fun together, we got kind of close. And the Ken Club was a place that was kind of a safe haven for me. It was sort of the end of the road place for me. And my last, close to my last drug, my last drinking, I went out on, I was on and off the streets and using any drug that you put in front of me, any alcohol, any drug, anything a man would put in front of me so that I could go home with him and steal whatever he had that I could get that I could walk out the door with. And I and that's how I functioned the last 2 years. I was in the Ken Club one evening, and there was a fellow in there, and he had speedballs. And so I'd been drinking vodka all day, and I went into the back alley with him to do the speedballs. And the next thing I happened is I came to at UCSD Medical Center as a Jane Doe, strapped to a bed. I was 82 pounds, hair hanging in my face all broken out from drugs. I was told I had pancreatitis. I had no idea why I was so sick all the time. And that if I kept drinking, I would probably die. And I checked myself out against medical advice, and I went back out there. And I probably was out there for about 10 days when I was standing on El Cajon Boulevard looking for anybody to get anything from, and a car pulled up. And I got into the car. It turned out it was my brother, who at the time had 10 months of sobriety. He was a heroin addict and an alcoholic, really alcoholic. And and when I got in the car to do my thing, he didn't recognize me. And he went home and told my folks, "I found her, she's dying." My folks hadn't had anything to do with me for about 2 years. I was in Las Colinas on Easter Sunday, one Easter Sunday, and I called them for help to get me out. It was Easter, for God's sakes. And they said, "No, you stay there. We're not coming to get you." And so from that moment on, I didn't need my family anymore. And so I hadn't had contact with them for about 2 years. So my brother went and told my folks I was dying. And my mother at that time had 10 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. Bitch. She planned an intervention. And about 10 days later, she and my brother, the real alcoholic, came down to El Cajon Boulevard to find me, and they found me. And my mother got out of the car on the street corner and said to me, your brother Tim, you know, he's really the alcoholic. Your brother Tim was in a motorcycle accident, and they're giving him last rites. And could you get over yourself long enough to come say goodbye?" And for whatever reason, I got in the car with her. And they drove up to Pomerata Hospital in Poway. And I was in the middle. They made sure I stayed in the middle. My mother up front, my brother behind me, and walked past the emergency room, and I had worked that emergency room, and I said, we're passing the emergency room, and she said, oh, well, they have them in a back room. And I got to that back room, and they opened the door, and sitting around the room was my entire family. And I looked at my mother, and I looked at her, and I said, you, how could you do this to me? Who do you think you are doing this to me? And I got up to leave. I got turned around to leave, and the woman who was organizing the whole deal said, Anne-Marie, why don't you sit down? I promise, if you do, you'll never have to go back out there again. Every person in my family told a story about me that I thought I had covered up very well. My qualities at that time in my life were deception, deceit, theft, fraud, and they had every one of them pinned. Every one of them. And it got to the end, and it was my dad's turn. And my dad started crying, and he said, I think this is my fault. I'm so sorry. And he went on to talk to me to say he wished he had never taken me out to the bars when he did. He wished he had never done that. He wished he had never done this. And then he looked around the room and he said, I better shut up now before they have an intervention on me. The next day, my folks took me down to 1111 Island Street, where I entered 7 Day. And I was very sick with DTs. My whole drinking career, I always knew if I found the right man with the right amount of money, I would be set. Everything would be okay. And I did try. I looked really hard. And you know, they all thought I was nuts. Everybody pegged me from the get-go. You know, I was one of these persons who I was laying next to. I was diddling your last name with my last name, naming our children, you know, at the baptismal reception. They knew I was a nut job. And so it's not funny that in detox I fell in love. And I met a man in detox, and that's what I focused on. I can't tell you anything about what happened in those 7 days. Other than I heard one woman tell me, you do whatever you have to do to stay sober. So this man and I left detox after 7 days, and you get a chip after 7 days for, I think the place is called Bigsley's? Beasley's, that's it, Beasley's. You get a chip, and if you take your 7 day chip into Beasley's, you get a free beer. So we headed straight to Beasley's. And Mike drank, and I didn't. I don't know why I didn't. I just thought I was going to be tough. And that man died in my arms of a methamphetamine overdose at 30 days of sobriety, of my 30 days of sobriety. I was angry, hostile, mean. I didn't want anything that you wanted or that you had unless you had money. I thought I'll stick around here long enough to feel like I'm feeling better. Because I was very, very physically ill, I'll stick around long enough to feel better, and then I'll be able to go back out there and do all that fun stuff again. But that's what I thought. That was the insanity of the disease for me. I went to my first AA meeting was at Monday Night Mission Hills. And I, you know, you could smoke there in those days, and I probably had 2 cigarettes hanging out of my mouth at all times. The F word was every other word out of my mouth. And they said, keep coming back. Stick around till the miracle happens. Well, I thought I needed money. That was really the forefront. And after I was about 6 months sober, I was able to go back to work. 6-8 months sober. And my dad gave me an old beat-up Ford Granada. And at this time, I had had my license revoked. I had failures to appear on a couple DWIs on the felony hit and run. I had failures to appear on a solicitation charge. I had no insurance. I had no car registration, but I needed to get to work, so my dad gave me this car. So I went up and down Georgia Street looking for a tag off someone else's car so that I could register my car. And I plastered the car with AA bumper stickers. The police will never bother me. I didn't know this at the time. I was driving up the 805 going towards Adams Avenue, and this old Ford Granada could hardly move. And it was just putzing, hardly getting up there to Adams Avenue. And this car was coming to the left of me, passing me, honking his horn. And I'm thinking, you asshole, just get out of my way. You can see I'm having trouble here. And he goes by me, and he goes like this. And when he went by me, I went like this. He had AA bumper stickers on the back of his car. And I didn't know that doing this, you know, was a positive thing in AA. I had no idea. I didn't do the steps. I didn't need the steps. I didn't need a sponsor. I didn't need any of that stuff. I needed a man. And I was about, 14 months sober. And I heard they had a meeting, a Friday night open meeting at the Heartland House. Ooh, men. And I got all dressed up on this Friday night to go to the Heartland House. And I get there, I go to the meeting, and no men pay attention to me. And so I'm really kind of depressed and feeling sorry for myself. And I'm driving down El Cajon Boulevard coming home. And I'm coming down towards Texas Street at the mobile station, the Arco station there. And as I'm coming down the hill, all of a sudden, a siren and lights go on behind me. And I have a cigarette in my mouth, and the cigarette falls into my lap. My lap starts smoldering. My knees start shaking because I know I'm going to prison. I know I'm going to prison. I get through the light. I go through the light. He's still behind me. I pull into the Arco station, and he keeps going. I knew in that instant that I did not want to live like this anymore. I didn't want to live always looking behind my back. And I had a woman's phone number in my car, and I called her. It was 10 o'clock at night, and I called her, and she came and she picked me up. She was from Monday Night Mission Hills, and she took me back to her apartment, and she did the first 3 steps with me that night. And the next morning, I turned myself in. That was the beginning of sobriety for me, was the steps. And when I turned myself in, I didn't get any prison time. It, just by miracle, I didn't get any prison time. I was given 5,000 hours of community service. phone on hotlines, you know, 8 hours, you know, to get 8 hours in, I'd spend. I worked at the Alana Club during the day at 30th and University. And my sponsor started talking to me about a fourth step. And I don't know about you, but when it came to fourth step and finding, you know, going through all that, I couldn't seem to find anything wrong with me. So she had me carry a pen and a piece of paper. And she said, when you think of things, write things down. Just carry this with you. It took me about 3 months to write anything down. But she kept working with me. She worked with me and she worked with me and she worked with me. And I finally got a fourth step done with her. And it was time for a fifth step. And for me, so much of my drinking and what I had done when I drank, the choices I made when I drank, I considered them sins because I was raised a Catholic and that's how I was raised to believe. And so when it came to the fifth step, I wanted to do it with a priest. I had a priest friend that I drank with. And I called him up and I said, Scott, do you know anything about the 12 steps? Oh, yeah, sure I do. He said, well, I want to do a fifth step with you. He said, okay, come on over Tuesday night. We'll do a fifth step. And I went over there and I did what to me was a confession. It was the best I knew how to do at that time. It was all I knew how to do at that time. And one of the things that had burdened me, the choices that had burdened me through my drinking, is that as good a Catholic as I was and didn't believe in birth control pills, I got pregnant probably 6, 7, maybe 8 times. I don't know. I still don't know. But I know what I chose to do with each of those pregnancies. So when I went to the priest, it was important for me to talk to him about that. And the priest told me at that moment, I was as godlike as any human being could ever be. That my alcoholism was like Christ carrying the cross. And that my sobriety in the steps was like Christ's resurrection. And some healing actually began with me. I was only able at that time to probably remember maybe a few things. And I was told by my sponsor, if I stick around here, I'll do the steps over and over and over again, and I'll uncover more every time I do them. And one of the I had a Jesuit priest in my family. He was an uncle. One of the things he told me is he said, you will never have any spiritual growth until you begin to forgive your family. Because I was still very angry at my mother for having that intervention. I was still very angry with my mother because of, at this time, when I got sober, I had blamed everything on her. It was, so she was sort of the person I had blamed everything on. My sponsor talked to me about character defects, and there was a man who I had gotten to know in early sobriety. He's dead now, so I can say his name. His name is Mike Volpe, and he encouraged me. He prayed for me to get involved with women's groups. I had nothing to do with women when I first got here because I had nothing to do with women when I was out there. I was threatened by women, and so I kept them at arm's length. And he encouraged me always to get involved in a woman's step study. Well, then he got bone cancer, and I began to take care of him. And He kept talking about a step study, women's step study, women's step study. And I said, okay, Mike, I'll get involved. I'll join a woman's step study if that'll make you feel better, because I wanted him to feel better when he was in so much pain. And he put me in touch with this gal, and she had a group of women that were starting a step study, and I said I would join up, and it was going to start the next Wednesday. Well, that Wednesday, I was on my way into Mike's hospital room, and the woman who was having the step study called on my pager to tell me that the step study was going to be canceled that day. Because a friend of hers was in the hospital dying. And I didn't know at that time that she was talking about Mike as I was going into the hospital. And Mike did die that night. And during that night, we said the rosary. And every woman who was going to be part of that step study, I met in that hospital room that night. And I began a step study. And I began to change my mind about women. And what I didn't know at that time was that my own father would be dead 5 months later. And that group of women would save my life. Character defects. Talk to me about the seventh step in character defects. And my sponsor, I had a really hard time with the God of my understanding when I first got sober. And I love animals. I'm an animal person. As a matter of fact, I've probably gotten along better with animals my whole life than I have humans. And I was getting ready to do, to look at my character defects. And I was living in an apartment in Carlsbad. And I was driving home this night, and there was a brown paper bag. And it was sort of bouncing up and down in my carport. And I decided to get out of the car and pick the bag up. And I opened the bag, and there were three kittens in it. Two of them were dead. One of them was just a little baby kitten. And somebody had thrown them across to reach a dumpster and had missed the dumpster, and they landed in my carport. And I looked at this kitten, and there was one animal I never did like, and it was cats. And I looked at this cat, and I said, I'll get you through the night, but you're going to the Humane Society first thing in the morning. And I went to Petco or one of those places and got the bottle and fed her all night, put her on the heating pad, and the next morning she just looked at me with those big eyes and she says, but aren't you my mommy? And I said, yes. That cat died in my arms at 17 years of age. She taught me unconditional love. That cat turned me from an animal into a human being. I began to learn how to treat human beings like I treated my animals. And soon after, I got a dog. And my sponsor, I was still having trouble with God. She said, but Anne Marie, dog spelled backwards is God. And so Riley Dog became my God. And Riley Dog died in my arms at 18 years of age. It was time for me to start making amends. And very hard thing for me to do. And I went to people, places, and things that I had stole from. I went to the IRS. I actually made amends with the IRS. That took me a couple years. I made amends to my mother, finally. My mother was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I thought she was going to die, so I thought I better forgive her. And it was a very, very powerful, powerful time in my life to make amends with my mother. And my mother and I have worked very hard since that time to have a mother-daughter relationship. Ooh. Then it's the 12th step. And I went back to detox in the beginning because that's all I knew. And those women didn't stay sober. They normally didn't even live. And I used to feel very responsible somehow for that. And my sponsor said to me, when did God go on vacation and leave you in charge? Of course you're not responsible for them drinking and killing themselves. I learned through her how to sponsor other women. And I'm looking at women in this room who I've sponsored, who mean the world to me and have saved my life. Thank you very much. My life today is so good. I can best describe it as in my reading this morning. My reading was, the spiritual life is not a theory. You have to live it. And it goes on to say, when I was a newcomer, I couldn't understand the meaning of living a spiritual life. Now today, I don't understand or comprehend a life without spirituality. I've found a God of my understanding who has all the answers. I ask for God's help every day, and I've learned how to love, how to care, how to have compassion for you and all my fellow human beings. I have a life that's full of joy today, where I had a life that was only fear. God is good. Thank you for 12-stepping me.